there are overwhelming, turbulent times, but that also means there is major potential to fill the cracks with new ideas and to transform these destructive systems. There are specific root causes for problems and holistic solutions everywhere. There is room for prosperity, there is room for regeneration and a shift in values. Another reality is possible, and that's what we're exploring here today. Welcome to Sage Talking.
My name is Kees Klomp, which is, well, very, very typically Dutch. If I would translate it into English, it would mean something like John Wooden Shoe. So it doesn't get more Dutch than my name. 45 years of age. I live in a rural part of the Netherlands, in the northern part of the Netherlands, with my wife. And I have three kids, of which two have already left the farm, because I live on a farm. I currently work, I co-work as a professor of applied science at the Rotterdam University of Applied Science, where I research economic system change. And I'm also co-founder of Thrive Institute, which is also located in Rotterdam, where we do all sorts of activities to basically empower and enable existential economics in the Netherlands.
One of your big topics also in the TED Talks was tackling our existential crisis by rethinking economics. And that obviously is already a very powerful title. So I want to talk to you a bit more about that. And first of all, the side of education, because I think that is still, that is something that is very relevant and something you can start a revolution with. You know, the way you teach people things, the way you empower students or don't empower students, I think that is obviously also a huge part of what forms society. So economics education at school, you've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. I want you to speak a little about how we are taught about economics at school versus the reality of the economic system that are creating crises, problems, shortages, monopolies, and also concentration of wealth. What are the big disparities here in why are we taught so one-sided about economics?
Yeah. Well, to make a long story short, and let me then elaborate a bit more on that. So the key problem is that we all had economics in secondary school, and well, almost all of us, there are some exceptions to the rule, but they're very, very rare. We are all basically brainwashed with a very specific form of economics, which is neoclassical economics. So we all went to school, we all were taught that economics is a social science, and then we were bombarded for years after years with this mathematical, abstract, natural science-like subject in school, which is only one of the many, many, many forms and schools within economics. And so economics is an abundantly diverse field of science, with many different scholars and schools and ways of thinking and ways of perceiving the world, but we weren't taught that at school. So we have been taught the neoclassical school, and the neoclassical school is very rigid in its approach. Hey, it approaches humans as the homo economicus, as rational beings. It basically boils down society to one big marketplace, and as this was taught to us in our formative years, we have all internalized this. We have become, we have been conditioned by this approach. So we take it for the truth, and because we take it for the truth, it's kind of dominating our worldview and our self-image. Yeah? So it basically becomes culture. And this is where it gets really problematic, because one of the aspects of neoclassical economics is the approach that we as humans are material beings, that we basically exist on this planet to fulfill material needs and wants. And don't get me wrong, we have material needs and we have material wants, but they're only one of the many, many aspects of wants and needs that we as humans have. And we also have social needs and emotional needs, and we have spiritual needs. And they don't play a role in neoclassical economics at all. It's only about material matters. It's only about GDP. It's only about marketplaces where people come to do transactions. And that is the reason why a lot of the problems, if not all the problems we are facing today, climate change, biodiversity loss, wealth inequality, political polarization, and in the enormous increase in depressions and burnouts, they all have one thing in common, and that is basically our worldview, our self-image, which have completely become economized. You know, we actually believe that a growing economy is is an indicator that a country is doing well, which is utter bullshit. It only means that we produce and consume more, which is a problem at this moment. We're in fact, and not a an indicator of well-being. We see that, for instance, in the Netherlands, and I know it's in the UK as well, and I know it's in well, basically the whole of Europe, that since the 1960s, our welfare has only grown at the expense of well-being. So we have become richer and richer and richer, but we haven't become happier. And that is all thanks to, well, basically the brainwash, the neoclassical brainwash, because in school there is no room for other economic approaches, like the feminist economist approach or ecological economist approach or Marxist economics approach. Whereas in fact they can teach us a lot of other perspectives on what is happening at us right now.
Yeah, I can completely relate to that because I went to my secondary school where I got my last degree from was a very business focused school, which is, I live in Germany. So that was a way to kind of get a further education. And I always felt completely uncomfortable at that school with the things I was taught. It felt like it all felt extremely abstract, very dry, not relatable. And it didn't feel like anything I was learning there was actually learning for life. And it was completely frustrating for me. So I can completely relate to what you're saying. And I think schools need to be, and the education there needs to be reformed so much. I think you're not really taught, at least in the schools I've been in Germany, a lot of value for actual life and also for a prosperous, self-sufficient life. So that is obviously a huge problem.
There is also very directly linked to the neoclassical economics approach, because in neoclassical economics, we can put a price tag on everything. So value is the same as price in neoclassical economics, which of course is utter bullshit. We were being taught that that is the norm. You know, if we can put a price tag on it, it has value. And if not, well, you know, then it's worthless because we can't work with it in an economic sense.
Yeah, definitely. You already touched on GDP. Could you debunk maybe some myths about the GDP and the gross domestic product of a country and about what it actually says about a country's economic activity?
Well, GDP is very flawed by nature. And the strange thing is that even the inventor of GDP, Kuznets, an economist, made that remark when he introduced GDP. And so he basically says, guys, this is an indicator that measures economic activities. So we can work with this to make economies grow, but it's a very flawed indicator. It only says that the economy is growing. But because of this, the mechanism in neoclassical economics where value and price are one and the same thing, and of course a growth in living standard in welfare is considered a grow in well-being. And so the premise that lies underneath GDP is that a growing economy is growing welfare, is growing well-being, which is not the case. So GDP basically, the only thing it does is sum up all the economic activities in a country, which, as I stated in my TED talk, where, you know, this is very uneasy, but it's the truth. It basically means that we only exist in a GDP-led country if something enters or leaves our wallets, because that's the only time when we actually add to the economy. And so everything we do that doesn't involve our wallets is considered worthless in our current economic system. And well, as you know, family, friends, sports clubs, all these things that are really, really, really valuable and essential even to a happy, healthy society don't count in this current economic system. They have been externalized. So GDP is a big, big, big problem. So that's why it's really good that at least five countries have now embraced gross national well-being instead of gross domestic product or gross domestic well-being. And New Zealand, Iceland, Finland, Wales, Scotland, and soon also Costa Rica will join the so-called WeGo countries, the well-being governments. And the big difference is that they basically left the monoistic indicator of GDP and replaced it with a set of sometimes more than 60 indicators that measure and report the well-being of a country rather than only the welfare of a country.
That's amazing. That makes so much more sense, obviously.
It does,
I mean, because obviously if people are happy, if they're healthy, if they feel like they have a sense and purpose in life, they will, although it's not about just, you know, working and the economy, they will obviously, if that's what the economy has in mind and wants, they will obviously work better. I mean, they will have more capacity to work well, to do a good job at whatever they're doing, as yes. If they feel they're waking up in the morning solely to work and pay their bills and do the same thing every day without a purpose or rhyme or reason behind it.
Well, one of the interesting things, and well, maybe you can elaborate a bit on the situation in Germany, but this is happening in the Netherlands right now, which is really promising and also really decisive, in my humble opinion, is the fact that centennials like yourself, the oldest centennials are now entering the workspace. And they are completely turning organizations from the inside out, because centennials want something more out of work than only a paycheck. And I call this the impact career path rather than the income career path. Yeah? So I'm Gen X, and my generation went to work driven by income. You know, what can I make in a month? When do I get a lease car? You know, what will be, when will I have a director on my, standing in front of my name? Yeah? So very, very material, very egocentric. Whereas a lot of your generation have a very different approach on work. Yeah. You were mentioning purpose already, which is really important, that work is more and more considered a way to self-realize, to self-develop, to get the most out of yourself. But more importantly, that work needs to enhance life rather than confront life. situation now in the Netherlands. So we have a government now that is making commercials on national TV to convince people to work more. Yeah. Because the economy wants more employees. You know, the companies are growing faster than the people want to work, which is very interesting. And so now we have things like conscious quitting and quiet quitting and bore out.
I've heard about that before as well. I have to say, for myself personally, where I live, it's also more a rural area, and to find more jobs you would have to go to the next bigger city, which is Munich. And for myself, I am having real such difficulties finding a job with purpose, because they have very specific values in mind, and things I want from a job. I want to create a positive impact. It should have purpose. It should be well-intentioned and actually help drive this positive change that we need, and not help uphold the status quo. So most of the work I've been doing throughout the last, let's say, 2 years was volunteering, working for free for organizations that maybe didn't have the budget that I really believed in. And that work had more value than a lot of the jobs I could have had around here, solely for the reason of making money. Obviously, I can't do that forever. And, you know, you still have to pay bills. You still have to make some money as well for basic daily needs. And I really don't need much, but I'm having real difficulties actually also in Munich finding, you know, a job with purpose, a job that wants to create, actual, just a better lives for people, a reconnection of humans and nature. So I totally, I can totally relate to that. And honestly, as I said, the work that I have done for nonprofit organizations that maybe didn't have the budget, or the work that I did for free, had in actuality a lot more value than many of the jobs I could have done here for money. And I have to say that I think in Germany, I know that centennials, a lot of them, they do want, they do have other values. They do want more than a paycheck, as you said. But I have to say, also maybe as it is in the Netherlands with those ads you were talking about, that many people are incredibly, as am I as a voter, disillusioned by our government, which is just pushing and working against everything that we want in the direction of positive actual change. And, you know, our Chancellor Olaf Scholz, he's definitely somebody very driven by the economy, very much in the pocket of corporations. And also our Green Party are bending and breaking all their promises that they made to young people, older people, to everybody. So it's not an easy kind of political and economical environment to live in. And as you know, Germany is very driven by its economy as well. So it's not easy.
No, it's not easy, but I do think it is decisive. So because I worldwide, you will be 30% of the world population very soon.
Yeah.
and that's dominant.
Yeah, definitely.
You will change the face of this planet, because and I know that this is in Germany as well. It is also happening in the Netherlands. There is this growing unease with the system. And that creates, you know, a very specific dynamics, that is also, in all honesty, a potentially chaotic and even dangerous era, because this is also a situation where we see extremists on both sides of the political spectrum, take a chance, so to say. I do believe that in the long run, it will lead to a more balanced outlook on life, because there is nothing wrong with the economy as such. You know, an economy is just a bunch of agreements in between people of how to run the material household. And there's nothing wrong with living standards. I think we both agree that it's a blessing to be born in Germany or in Netherlands. There Yes. are a lot of places in the world that are very much worse off than we. The only thing is it is enough.
Yeah.
You know, limits that we have reached the limits of growth and the limits of wealth. It's more than enough. We just have to change the way that we distribute, the way that we value things, and then we can create a wonderful society where people can flourish and blossom, and not only humans, because I think that is one of the most important points I stress with existential economics. You know, our existence depends on all living things on this planet. Distance is by definition coexistence, and maybe the most poisonous, the most toxic thing of our economic system is it is right now is that it's killing life.
Yeah.
And with killing life, we are killing ourselves.
Yeah. 100%.
And that is a system flaw that is so huge, and we have to take care of that.
Yeah.
Really important.
What, in your opinion, are some of maybe the biggest myths or lies that right now governments are telling people about economic prosperity and the ways that they say the economy must go in order for a country to be prosperous and to run smoothly? Is there anything you want people to know that many people believe that is not actually so because they're being told by the government?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There are a couple. First of all, the myth that economic growth is a sign, an indicator of a country doing well. It has nothing to do with that. A growing economy is just showing that that the economy is growing, that we produce and consume and distribute. Basically, that is what a growing economy means. So GDP growth is nothing more than GDP growth. A second thing which is really dominant and which is also a fundamental untruth is trickle down. So trickle down means that if we let the rich people get richer, if we create a system that enables the wealthy people in a society to become wealthier, the wealth will trickle down to the rest of the people. This is also complete utter bullshit. There is no such thing as trickle down. It never existed. And it will never exist. There's an abundant scientific proof that to also show this, that trickle down doesn't work. It only creates more distance between the have and the have-nots in a society. And a third really, really important myth that we have to debunk is that a degrowth scenario, so a scenario where the economy doesn't grow but actually shrink, is a disaster. That is also fundamentally untrue. Degrowth is a very valid, a very solid way to accept the fact that we have reached the limits of our finite planet, and also our finite borders as human beings. We also have our limits, and we have reached that limit. And we, like I showed you, the economy wants us to do more work. And so our government tries to convince us that it's utterly normal to have two jobs. Because if you have two jobs, you can buy more, you can spend more. And we come to the conclusion that we can't work two jobs. So we burn out. So I think those three are hugely important. GDP is a flawed indicator that doesn't say anything except that the economy is growing, trickle down doesn't exist, and degrowth is isn't dangerous, but actually a very viable, valid scenario to proceed.
Yeah, and I all your points there are so I think they're so valuable and for people to know and to realize. And I think one of the things that is also, you know, sometimes we talk about these things and people know there are a lot of problems with the current economic system and capitalism and so on. But I think actually the effect it has on people and societies, and I want to dive in that a little deeper. And I'm going to share something just because I want this podcast, you know, to be very open and also emotional, because I think all these topics, they're not just, you know, numbers and research. They're also very emotional topics. As you said, as humans, we have many different sides to us. We have also spiritual needs, emotional needs, and so on. And at the beginning of this year, I was actually, for personal reasons, in a psychosomatic clinic. And most of the people who were there that I met were there because of depression and burnout. And yeah. I think that is so, and it made me so feel so helpless and just mad, you know, at the world in that moment, because it was like, you know, this day-to-day life that many of us consider so normal, the huge negative effects they actually have on people, on their lives, on how stressed and frustrated they are, on how people, you know, most of the people there, they weren't like crazy or sick people. They were people who were actually, you know, run down just by their everyday, by simply their everyday lives and providing for their family. And that shouldn't break you, you know, and cause you to be completely depressed or burn out to a point that you can't go on with your regular life anymore.
No, but you know, Stella, what is the sheer toxicity of what you are stating goes even one step further, and that is why I call my approach existential economics, because we identify with this system. So it's not only that we work hard, but it goes way deeper. You know, we associate ourselves with what we basically have, what we make. And this is not fantasy. This is actually culture. And so if you're a have not, then you're a have not.
Yeah.
You know, it's real. It isn't a fantasy, it's real. Yeah? So there is a very clear distinction between people that we consider successful, which means that they have material wealth, they have acquired material wealth, and the people that aren't able to do this. And this is a matter of identity. So it's not about job, it's not about salary, it's not about a paycheck. It's about me. It's about you. and that is the real toxicity of this system, that we, you know, we don't only live in the system also lives in us.
Yeah.
You know, we are the system. So people get all these spiritual, mental issues because they completely identify with the way that the system has put a price tag on them. You know, we have become material beings fundamentally, because we're not, it creates deep tension and depression. So it's very serious. I can't state this more than I would like to scream this out, so that everybody could hear how important this is.
Yeah, you know? Definitely.
Don't believe the fucking hype.
Yeah, 100%.
You're not a price tag. You're a human being, and the fact that you suffer in this system is actually a sign that you are human.
Yeah, definitely. It's a sign of our humanity, and as you said, you can't put a price tag on it because the simple fact that the small regenerative farmer next door does more for the world, does more for people, more for nature than any CEO in a high-rise building who makes more money than in 1 year than that farmer in his entire life.
Yes.
Maybe could provide you actually see how value has nothing in the world to do with money, morals, or ethics. I would even argue that probably the more money people have, the less they, the lower they go on the value and morals scale, which is actually just a sign of really how, you know, how those people prosper in a system that values those lower morals and ethics, which is obviously you can rise very high if you have those lower morals and ethics maybe and are willing to also do things that are not so ethical. But obviously if you have, if you want regeneration, if you want to work closely with nature in this economy, you are not going to be one, probably easily rise to the very top to be the ones who have the things to say, which is now a little more what I want to focus on, because I mean that's often what is called grassroots, you know, because the change, as they say, grows from the ground up and doesn't come from the top down, because obviously the ones that are on the top are probably very happy with how it's going and want to uphold that status quo. So I want to focus a little more on the positive, on the empowering side. So how, what are some of the things we can do in an economy, as a society? How can we start breaking these associations that you said, or the culture, how you called it, of this capitalistic thinking of the system? Because, you know, many people say we have to change the economic system, we have to make changes, and you're researching that, so maybe can you tell us a little bit, how can that happen, how can we make that change happen, and is it better to create a new system from ground up, or right now with a limited time frame, would you just change and reshape the existing system?
Well, so my, I have developed a theory of system change, and it has three pillars. These pillars are immersion, dissolution, and implosion. And let me take you through these three. And what is really important is that the sum of these three pillars, of these three elements, I call story making. So I think that the way to perceive system change is to create story change and story making. And what I mean with story making is I studied political science and communications in the 80s of the previous century, and at that time Marshall McLuhan was still very much happening, and Marshall McLuhan is famous for his sentence, "The medium is the message," and I believe that the maker is the message. And so what we need is to create a new story through makers, through people that are actually living the new standard, that are living the new system. And I study these story makers, and they have three things in common, really important. So the first is immersion. So immersion is a term that is derived from virtual reality. Yeah? So to immerse means that you get very up and close with issues. So I interviewed hundreds of social entrepreneurs, which are people that start a business with an explicit social mission. And what I found out is that they have one thing in common. Although their social enterprises can go in very many different directions, they all have one thing in common, which is a very definitive moment wherein a certain societal issue became personal for them. They all experienced a calling. They were being called. And this is actually what purpose is all about. Purpose is about the understanding that you are big, that you are part of something bigger than yourself, and that you have a role to play in that bigger field, so to say. So that is really important. So it all starts with not fighting or flight or showing a flight from societal suffering, but to actually do the opposite, to move towards the pain and the suffering. That is really, really important. That's the starting point. So all story makers, all people that I consider people that help to change the system, they all made a very deliberate personal decision to take the pain of society and to do something with it. So that's the first one, immersion. Then the second one, also really important, is dissolution. And dissolution is a term that was coined by Martha Beck, an American sociologist. And dissolution is actually the opposite of revolution. So we know revolutions as an overthrowing of power. So we have power structures. And one way to deal with them is that we fight the power and we try to overthrow it. But what we can learn from Martha is that you can also dissolve power structures. So you can try to fight them, but that actually empowers them. But if you take away the power that power holds over you, there is no power anymore. So there's only power if you let power have power over you. To put it in a more philosophical sense, more metaphilosophical. So dissolution means that you take away the power structures by doing things that dissolve their power structures. So for instance, the enormous rise of people starting commons and cooperatives in the Netherlands, and I'm sure that's also the case in Germany, that's a form of dissolution. So people start to grow their own food together with other people, or they start energy cooperation, which basically means that they take away the power of the market. Because by doing it yourself, by doing it together with other people, you don't need the market to do it anymore. Yeah? So that is dissolution. So dissolution is really important because it enables you to decondition, to not only think critical, but also to do critical. And then last but not least, and this is really also really important as well, is amplition. And amplition is a term that is derived from the positive psychology and health movement. And what it basically does is it's actually the opposite of curation. So curation means that if there is a problem, if people become ill, we try to better them. We send them to hospitals, to a doctor, and then the doctor cures them. Curation. But amplition is the exact opposite. And it's all about how can we amplify? Amplition is about amplifying. How can we amplify the positive energy that is existing in this system? Yeah? So rather than focusing on the problems, you can also focus on the possibilities. We can focus on the deficit, but we can also focus on the assets. And story makers, system changers, are really, really, really good to focus their time and attention and effort on the positives. So not fight the system, but make the existing system obsolete by enhancing the new initiatives, the new standards, so to say. And so I think those three are really important. First of all, immerse with suffering. Don't shy away, but go towards it. Then dissolve the power structures that are in place. And then last but not least, amplify the constructive and positive elements within in society. And I think if we can work on those three elements, we can change the system.
Yeah, that is, I hope people have been writing things down. I hope everybody got a notepad and pad and has been writing this down. You actually gave me so much more inspiration right now. I've been actually taking notes because on the weekend I'm doing a presentation on a localization and a regional economy and decentralization of energy and food, etc. All the needs that we have.
That's dissolution, right? For
yeah.
You. that's dissolution all over the place.
You know? Yeah, but, and you just gave me so many more points, and because I'm doing that in my town hall, and because I want to kind of help empower the town. But here it's a little town in Bavaria, and it's there's a lot of resistance, I have to say, from the mayor, from other entities. So I'm working on that, and I'm kind of building up this presentation that I also want to take into schools, which is also a lot of resistance there. But
but Stella, resistance only means that you're actually making a point. Yeah? So you have to look in another way at resistance. Resistance doesn't mean that you are being blocked. It's actually you're being a plot.
an interesting view.
it's a way of the current system to deal with you. And of course, you know, the current system can't applaud you because you are considered a threat. But the way that they resist you is showing that they take you serious. So hooray.
Well, that's very good to hear. That's definitely a motivator. Thank you. I also wanted to ask, are you on that note, talking about kind of changing the economic scenario, are you an advocate for local, regional, or maybe even national economies, you know, that are more tailored to a country's landscape, resources, culture? And would that be, you know, kind of economics that are more that differ, you know, like different economies in different places, mm-hmm. that stay in one place, that are not necessarily connected to a global market, and you know, not really influenced by it? And would you see something like that being possible to establish in different places relatively quickly, you know, seeing our window of opportunity to stay within 1.5 degrees is extremely narrow right now, and closing fast?
Yes, well, I'm currently writing a new book which has the working title Communism, so not communism, but commonism. I think that word boils it all down in one word. So I heartily believe that we have to look beyond capitalism. And I think the rise of commons is actually the way forward. So we have to take away the power that the market has over us. And I also think that market and state are so entangled that there is also no hope from the current state. So from politics. But the good news is we can arrange a lot of our of the things that we need to create a prosperous society ourselves by organizing it directly from civilian to civilian. Yeah? So let's say a sort of peer to peer, and I call this co-sufficiency. Yeah? So the current system is all about self-sufficiency. You know, you are responsible for your own success. If you do well, if you become materially successful, you can be self-sufficient. And that is a very toxic theme. But co-sufficiency is a wonderful, aspirational way to look at a community. I mean, you know, if we would be able to create co-sufficient communities, local, where people know each other, work together for the common good, we can create a completely new society. And I call these initiatives the multi-local. So our current economic system is run by corporates, also known as multinationals. But I think the future is all about the multi-local. And the multi-local means that, for instance, your regenerative farm, it can only work in the place it is based. You know, you can't create more scale than the place is offering you. But what you can do is use the same mechanics, the same methods on other places. And so what we see is that a lot of commons, for instance, food commons, where people, 500 families or inhabitants, co-create a food supply system where they co-own a farm, where they build their own food and they distribute their own food, you know, without market, without shops, they co-own the farm. That is a method that can work literally everywhere else on this planet. So we don't need a huge, gigantic farm in the area of Munich to feed the world. We need a method that can be copied in other places based upon this co-sufficiency and common method. And it is very, very possible. The issue is, the challenge is, it is completely the opposite of the system that is in place now. So we have to dissolve the structures that withdraw or withhold us to get there. But we can do this.
Yeah, I think we can. And I think it's just a matter of kind of waking people up and, you know, getting them also to realize that, for example, in this town that I live in or that anybody lives in, you know, we are this town, we are this community. And actually, I think there's always this thinking and putting ourselves into the second, third, or even fourth row behind corporations, politicians. And it always feels, you know, we are always being governed and we are always letting other entities govern us, as, because it has been outsourced in a way, as you said it before.
That is the way the power works. Yeah? So we have come accustomed with consuming governance, which makes us dependent.
Yeah.
But there is nothing that holds us from doing it ourselves.
Yeah, and that also holds us from taking back the power. Yes. And I think it's just gaining more momentum. It's gaining more attention, and people feel more drawn to it, because I think after these last few centuries that were, as you described, very materialistic, very focused on money, on income, there's a new narrative, and just people are just hungry for more, for something different, because they're feeling that this is not actually, you know, our core human values or what we actually desire as humans. And after a while, after this high of kind of, you know, in the 70s, 80s, everything was like so economically driven, and especially in Europe, people were, you know, kind of high on life, and everything was going back up after the war. And then you feel quickly that this is not it. It's not what sustains us as humans, and no, can't be sustained, because, you know, at one point, as you said before, we'll reach the limits. We already have reached the limits, and from there it can only go downhill.
Stella, it's even worse. You know, we have to reclaim the commons, because what we have forgotten is that the commons are way older than capitalism. Yeah? We have been commodified, but commodification is not a given or a fact. It's created. So the market, the commodification of our society is something that has very deliberately happened over the last centuries. But before capitalism, we used to live based upon the commons. So it's reclaiming. And another way of putting it is, I sometimes say to my students, it's not about fuck the system, because fuck the system is revolutionary language, but it's hack the system. And we have to hack the system. We have to make use of everything that's out there, the infrastructure, to hack the system itself.
Yeah.
That is dissolution. That is what we can do. And we can do this. It's just a matter of not going along with the rules of the games anymore. Change the rules.
Yeah, I must say, I am extremely impressed and inspired by your wisdom, your clarity, and the work that you do. And, you know, as you said before, if you know, I'm already being a little bit of a tiny threat to the system, then you must be a very big threat. So thank you very much for that and for changing the narrative and for spreading this message and also helping me, you know, create a talk on this podcast that can hopefully inspire and motivate people to look at themselves, their own lives, the communities they're living in, and see what we can all collectively change, you know, by helping each other to realize that there are ways to do it differently.
But Stella, because I find this really important, thank you for your kind words, but you know, we are story makers. There is no difference between you and I. Our place in society might be different because I'm older and I live in the Netherlands and I'm a professor of applied science, la-di-da. But what we share is much, much, much more important. Eh? So you are a story maker and your podcast is a way to weave us story makers into one story. I find it utterly important what you are doing, and I applaud you for it. And I hope that you can weave a lot of other story makers in your area, because we need each other. It's not about status or whatever. That's the old bullshit. we're in this together.
Also, I want to acknowledge and honor Indigenous and First Nations peoples as custodians of most of planet Earth's biodiversity and bearers of ancient knowledge. I pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize all Indigenous and First Nations peoples' strength, resilience, and deep connection to nature. Thank you.